From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
I've seen some of the worst things man can do to wildlife, and the worst for me is the way a poacher hacks a horn off a rhino's face.
Today, National Geographic reporter Brian Christie discusses his investigation into the illegal rhinoceros horn trade. Besides being cruel to rhinos,
there are human trafficking organizations, drug traffickers, arms traffickers, financed in part by the illegal rhino horn trade.
Also, we talk with Bob Weir, the singer, songwriter, and guitarist, and founding member of the Grateful Dead. His new album is inspired by his time working on a Wyoming ranch when he was 15.
In the evening, the old boys would pop a cork and they'd tell stories and sing songs. And I was the kid with the guitar, so I was their accompaniment. I learned a bunch of that stuff and got steeped in that tradition.
That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the world of illegal wildlife trafficking, the most valuable appendage, more valuable than elephant ivory, is the horn of the rhinoceros. Most of the horn comes from South Africa, which is home to nearly 70% of the rhinos left on Earth. The most lucrative destination for smugglers are China and Vietnam, where many people believe that rhino horn has therapeutic qualities. My guest Brian Christie has written an article about this booming illegal trade for the October issue of National Geographic magazine. He's chief correspondent for the National Geographic Society's Special Investigations Unit. Selling rhino horn was banned in 1977 by the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, known by its acronym CITES. Christie just returned this week from the latest CITES meeting in South Africa, where the ban on the sale of rhino horn was upheld. Just to give you a heads up, this interview includes a brief but disturbing description of how poachers remove rhino horns. Brian Christie, welcome back to Fresh Air. So I've never met a rhino. You've been face-to-face with rhinos. What's it like to see a rhino close up? What are they like?
I wondered what that would be like, too. And I really looked forward to seeing my first rhino in the field. And unfortunately for me, my first rhino was a poached rhino in Mozambique. And, you know, it's...
So it was already dead when you saw it?
Yeah, it was dead. It had been shot by poachers, had its horn hacked off. The body was decomposing. And I learned that a baby was somewhere nearby waiting for its mother. That was my first experience.
A baby rhino?
A baby rhino, yeah. I didn't want my first experience to be a victim, but it was, and it's appropriate as part of the story of what's happening to rhino that I wasn't deluded, even from the very beginning, that this is what's going on. It's a brutal, corrupt, violent world.
But tell us about live rhino.
Yeah, live rhino are extraordinary. They're these plated, armored vehicles walking around, these prehistoric animals. And I had heard things about them before starting this project. You know, they don't see well. They're very violent. They're very aggressive. The hunting community counts them as one of the big five, one of the deadly animals of Africa. And in fact, they're, for the most part, placid. They walk around the white rhino. The southern white rhino in particular is an animal you can drive right up to. And I started to hear from biologists all sorts of new information about how rhinos communicate. And they communicate through these squeaks and squeals that's fun to listen to. And they're not these solitary, violent, raging animals that I had heard about.
So rhinos are an endangered species right now. You're writing about the rhino horn trade. So for those of us in the U.S. who have no contact with rhinos, why do we care?
Well, we ought to care because the illegal rhino horn trade, like the illegal ivory trade, is something that criminal syndicates are using to finance all sorts of illegal activity. There are human trafficking organizations using rhino horn, drug traffickers, arms traffickers, financed in part by the illegal rhino horn trade. The illegal wildlife trade destabilizes key governments across Africa. And there is something at work in South Africa that I've never seen anywhere else before, and that is the ranching of wildlife. I was shocked upon arrival in South Africa to learn that rhino aren't roaming around free in South Africa the way I expected as a boy growing up in New Jersey. They are, in fact, ranched like cattle. In fact, the largest operation there looks like a dairy farm.
So there's a big market for rhino horn, and your article is about the illicit trade in rhino horn. What makes rhino horn seem valuable?
To a Westerner, it's unbelievable that anyone could pay the prices they do.
What kind of prices are we talking?
The prices are depend on which country you're in, whether you're on the source side, the African side, or the the end user side. In South Africa, according to underworld figures I spent time with, it's about $3,000 a pound for rhino horn. That moves up by factors of 10. So you get rhino horn in Vietnam and China for $15,000 a pound, $30,000 a pound. And rhino horn is often sold for, its primary use is Asian medicine. So it's often sold by the gram. And if you start breaking it down into gram lots, then the prices just skyrocket from there.
What is it supposed to be therapeutic for people who believe that it is?
Yes, unfortunately, there was a statement a few years ago by a Vietnamese public figure who said rhino horn was good for cancer. And that is one of the main drivers now of rhino horn powder consumption, is it can cure cancer. It's believed to cure. There is a significant industry collecting venomous sea snakes for food. And those who collect those sea snakes, if they're bitten by the snake, rub rhino horn on it, believing it will cure them. It's used for hangovers. It's sort of a party drug of the moment.
Aphrodisiac.
Aphrodisiac as well. And in fact, I looked into that, and the aphrodisiac, it's now sold as an aphrodisiac, but that's not because it's traditionally thought of as an aphrodisiac. It's rather that Western media has gotten it wrong for the last several years, claiming that it's an aphrodisiac, and the Vietnamese and Chinese started following that. In other words, they are now selling it, even though it wasn't their idea. It was an error in Western media.
So rhino horns look like they're bony protuberances, but they're not bone. They're keratin, which is a protein that's in hair and in fingernails. So when somebody cuts off a rhino horn, like, how do they do it? What are they doing? And I should mention here that the horn eventually grows back, kind of like your fingernails do.
Yeah, that's the both amazing thing and the sad thing about the rhino is the rhino horn, unlike the tusk of an elephant, which is a tooth, the rhino horn will grow back. If you cut it not too low, not too close to the head, it will grow back. In general, if you're doing it as a farmer of rhino, you drug your rhino and then you use a sawzall, an electric saw, to saw the end of the horn off. In the field, poachers will use a machete, and the way the rhino horn attaches to the skull of the rhino is sort of like a wart, I guess, and you can stick the point of your machete under that and pop it off the rhino's face. And when you're doing it quickly in the field, that's one of the ways they do it.
There's a photo that the photographer Brent Sturton took for your story of a rhino that had its horn taken off in the way you just described, and there's like a hole in his head where the horn used to be. It looks really horrible.
I've seen some of the worst things man can do to wildlife, and the worst for me is the way they take the horns off, the way a poacher hacks a horn off a rhino's face. These aren't dead rhino most of the time. The way these poachers take out a rhino to do it quickly and most assuredly is they just shoot to break the rhino's front leg. Rhino goes down, it's immobile, you can go up, it doesn't have to be dead.
And it's experiencing all the pain.
All the pain. And in fact, the mother, this becomes difficult, but the mother will keen like a whale, and it will, and a baby that's fled out of fear will come back. And the poachers don't shoot that baby. They'll hit it in the spine with their machete to paralyze it so that they save a bullet.
Why not just let the baby live?
They want the baby's horn, too.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, so there's a little baby horn they can take.
Yeah, every ounce.
Huh. So one of the people you spoke to for your article is a rhino farmer, John
Hume.
John Hume. And his argument is, first of all, he owns them. And second of all, this is great for conservation because rather than poaching them and herding them, you know, he immobilizes them, anesthetizes them, cuts off the horn in a place so that it can still grow back, so that the animal doesn't feel pain and isn't permanently damaged in any way. So he asks, what's wrong with that? So what do conservationists have to say in answer to that?
I think there are two primary concerns. First, in a perfect world, John Hume's absolutely right. the rhino, as he puts it, you know, the rhino can pay for its own protection. You can dart your rhino, cut the horn off. The rhino is fine afterwards, and sell the horn, and it, you can use the money to pay for conservation of that rhino and other rhino around the world. The problem is that we don't live in a perfect world, and the level of corruption in these legal systems is extraordinary. And when you open the door to a legal trade, you also open a door to a new level of illegal activity. And that's the fundamental insight for me of this project, the last year I spent in the rhino world, is that the legal systems in place in South Africa are incapable of policing most forms of crime in South Africa, let alone wildlife crime, which is a very low priority in general.
So right now, the rhino horn trade is illegal in South Africa. But what John Hume, who is a South African rhino farmer, is doing is banking rhino horn. He's hoping and expecting that someday soon it's going to be legal to sell them. So he has, what, hundreds and hundreds of horns in safe places ready to be sold as soon as it becomes legal to sell them. And how many horns does he have?
He's got 5 tons of horn at least in stockpiles. He has a security service that comes to his farm twice a week to collect the horns that he's cut for that week. And you're right, the estimated value of his collection at the moment is $45 million in horn, banking on the ban on rhino horn trade, both in South Africa and internationally, that both those bans will be struck down.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Christie. He's the chief correspondent of National Geographic Society's Special Investigations Unit, and his latest investigation is into the illegal trade in rhino horn, and that's his latest story in National Geographic. We're going to take a short break here, then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Christie. He's the chief correspondent of the National Geographic Society's Special Investigations Unit, and his latest article is about the illegal trade in rhinoceros horns. So one of the people you write about in your investigation into the illegal rhino horn trade is Dawie Groenewald, who's an accused rhino trafficker. And he's been called the Butcher of Proctig, and Proctig is the name of his rhino hunting property. Why was he given the name of the Butcher?
Dawie Groenewald has 2 properties. He has a 4,200-acre hunting property in northern South Africa, just below the Zimbabwe border. And on that property, he had been accumulating rhino for quite some time and cutting off their horns like other rhino ranchers. Except the South African police believed he was trafficking in those horns against the law. And they raided his property in 2010, and they discovered pits, these giant pits of rhino bodies, carcasses that had been burned. And he had apparently been hacking the horns out of these rhino in brutal ways. And he got the nickname Butcher Proctig from that experience. They've associated 439 rhino horns with his operation there.
There's currently a lot of charges against him in South Africa. What are some of those charges?
Moving a rhino without a permit, cutting the horn off without a permit, selling that horn without a permit. Each is a crime and a count. And then he faces more standard organized crime counts for money laundering and the like.
So Dawie is somebody who believes if he owns the animals, like he owns the rhino, that he can kill them, he could dehorn them, he could do whatever they want because they're his property. And In fact, that's how the world works when it comes to farming. If you're farming chicken or pigs or whatever, you can, you know, bring them to slaughter and use them for whatever. So are we talking about a double standard here? Like, why do conservationists say that he's wrong when he says that?
Well, chickens and cattle aren't endangered. And these are endangered species. And to some degree, they're part of the global commons. They are a global asset. And in any case, the world has agreed to certain standards with respect to how these can be traded and how they can be treated. And Dawi has thumbed his nose at all of that. And this is a metaphor for South Africa's approach to wildlife. He says, this is mine. If it is on my land, it is mine. And I can do anything I want with it.
Somebody else who you write about is involved with the illegal rhino trade is Hugo Ross, who you describe as a luxury safari operator and accused rhino killer. What's he accused of?
Hugo Ross is considered a potentially more violent version in the rhino horn trade. He is accused of using a veterinary drug called M99 to kill rhino, both on properties he controls and on other properties, which would make him a poacher in South Africa. And this is one of the interesting things in South Africa. If you kill a rhino on your property, people regularly said to me, you know, Dawi's not so bad. They were his rhino. And these are law enforcement. These are veterinarians. They were his rhino. Hugo Ross has been accused of killing other people's rhino. And for that, South Africans condemn him. And he himself, this isn't in the story, but I went to visit Hugo in prison in Pretoria. And Hugo confessed to me, yes, I trafficked horns the way the government says I did. But I did not poach. I am not a poacher. My son, and he started to break down, my son is 7 years old. I do not want him to think my father is a poacher. And that's amazing to me.
Because?
Because you're killing rhino in either case, and it's so much a question in South Africa of what is property? Whose is this? It's my right.
So Hugo Ross, who we've been talking about, his hunting clients have included Donald Trump's sons, Donald Jr. and Eric. So what did they do? They went on a Hugo Ross safari?
Yes, both sons hunted with Hugo Ross in the early 2000s, 2004, 2005. They hunted a variety of game, including sort of all your plains game. They went on a lion hunt, and Ross described to me their time with him.
So for someone like John Hume, who has this huge rhino farm, how do you buy rhino? Like, how do you create a rhino farm?
South Africa has game auctions, and you can buy rhino the way you would buy cattle in the United States. And again, this is something that was amazing to me, that all of the animals you might think of hunting on an African safari are being ranched in South Africa. So you have sable antelope ranches, you have impala ranches, you have rhino ranches, you have a private rhino owners association. And it's astounding. They have privatized all aspects of what is wild. And this is what is so important to me in the big scheme of things, for how we relate to nature as we continue to occupy space. Do we own it or do we coexist with it? And South Africans have chosen to own it. And if they don't own it, they don't really care about it.
When farmers buy rhino at an auction, like you described, what is the origin of the rhino? Are the rhino being sold, rhino that were farmed, or are they being taken captive from the wild? Where do they come from?
There's an amazing footnote in the history of the southern white rhino, which is the most traded rhino. Is that at the turn of the last century, they were down to less than 100 rhino in the world. And a group of South Africans began breeding them and moving them and spreading them out. And all white rhino today, all 19,000 or so of them, can be traced back to these 100 or so founder rhino. And so the rhino being traded today largely are the offspring of that limited population. And for the most part, they're legally traded. Kruger National Park, from time to time, considers it has too many rhino, and it will sell rhino. It sold rhino to Dawie Grunewald, for example, and use the funds to fund itself.
Isn't that an argument for farming rhino? I mean, it was like farming rhino that saved them from extinction in the first place.
Absolutely. And it would be a great argument if the legal system were up to the task of policing it. And it's clearly not.
Brian Christie, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been an honor.
Brian Christie is chief correspondent of the National Geographic Society's Special Investigations Unit. His article about the illegal trade in rhinoceros horn is in the October issue of National Geographic. After we take a short break, we'll hear from Bob Weir, a founding member of the Grateful Dead. He has a new album. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CarMax, a nationwide retailer of used vehicles where people can buy or sell their car, offering written vehicle appraisals good for 7 days. Learn more at CarMax.com. CarMax. Drive what's possible. And from Caroline Records, with the new Van Morrison album, Keep Me Singing, featuring 13 tracks, including Too Late. Keep Me Singing is available now at Amazon and other music retailers.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On New Year's Eve in 1963, a 16-year-old Bob Weir ran into Jerry Garcia at a music store in Palo Alto. They decided to start a jug band, which evolved into the Grateful Dead. They got their first break as the house band for Ken Kesey's Acid Tests and epitomized the psychedelic sound of the counterculture. In the band, Weir was one of the two main singers and songwriters and played rhythm guitar. The Dead toured almost constantly until 1995, when Jerry Garcia died. Bob Weir has continued to play music and has just released his first album of completely new material in 30 years. It's called Blue Mountain. Many of the songs were co-written with Josh Ritter. Weir says the album was inspired by the time when, as a teen, he ran away to work on a cattle ranch in Wyoming. The ranch was owned by the parents of John Perry Barlow, who later became Weir's songwriting partner. Bob Weir recently received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Americana Music Association. Weir spoke to Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. They started with the opening track from Blue Mountain. It's called Only a River.
Only a river. I was born up in the mountains, raised up in a desert town, and I never saw the ocean till I was close to your age now. Oh, Shenandoah, I long to see you. Hey, 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 your rolling river. Oh, Shenandoah, I long to see you. Hey, 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 only your river gonna make things right. Only your river gonna make things right. Only your river gonna make things right.
That's Only a River, the opening track of Bob Weir's new album, Blue Mountain. Bob Weir, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, hi.
You said that this album was inspired by a summer when you ran away to become a cowboy in Wyoming. How old were you?
I was 15.
So did you already know how to ride? Were you herding cattle?
Yeah, when I was a little kid, my folks were sort of in the horsey community. And also we used to vacation up in Squaw Valley, which in the wintertime was in California here. In the wintertime it was a ski resort. In the summertime it was a cattle ranch. And during the summers when we were up there, there was a riding stable that we spent a lot of time at. And the old cowpokes who ran the riding stable, a couple of them took a shine to me and sort of taught me how to ride and some of the basic skills of cowboying, you know, how to cut cattle and stuff like that. I never did really learn how to rope very well. But by the time I was 9 or 10, I had a pretty good grasp of the basics.
Through your career, you've seemed to be drawn to cowboy and country songs. Some of them you've written, like Mexicali Blues, and then you've also covered a lot of songs like Me and My Uncle, Marty Robbins' song El Paso. You've also done songs like Johnny Cash's Big River. Why do you think you're drawn to those tunes?
You know, I've actually wondered that myself. And you know, it occurs to me that I lived that lifestyle for a little bit, not just that summer, but I'd go back out there and work with Barlow. And, you know, part of working with Barlow when I was doing that was we'd live on the ranch and we had the ranch to run. And if I helped out, we'd have more time to write. So I spent a lot of time doing that kind of stuff. And I kind of got steeped in that tradition a little bit. And also, for what it's worth, when I was a kid living there in the bunkhouse, there were, you know, in the evening, the old boys would, they'd pop a cork and they'd tell stories and sing songs. And I was the kid with the guitar, so I was their accompaniment. Mm-hmm. And so I learned a bunch of that stuff. And as I say, got steeped in that tradition. And I just sort of carried it around in my hip pocket for the rest of my days. But it's not so much the songs that stuck with me as the delivery, mm-hmm. and particularly the storytelling aspect of singing those songs, of putting them across.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because I've noticed that that it feels like you like songs that have a narrative to them. A lot of your songs they tell some kind of a story, which I think contrasts with the other main songwriting team of the Grateful Dead, Jerry Garcia and Robin Hunter. Their songs were often like impressionistic. They were like, they would generally like evoke a mood or something. Whereas when I listen to your songs, I find myself imagining a specific narrator, a character. Do you think that's true?
Well, that's kind of my approach. That's what I'm most comfortable with. For years, I've held forth with the opinion that that every artist of any stripe is first and foremost a storyteller. And the story can be impressionistic or it can be linear in nature, and I'm comfortable with either of them, though when I set pen to paper, more often than not, it comes out more or less linear. You know, I see songs as little movies, mm-hmm. you know, short movies, and I try to let the characters most fully, as fully as possible, express themselves and let the story develop so that there's, you know, there's intrigue and all that kind of stuff.
So you have a song on the new album, Blue Mountain, that's called Kai Bossy, which is about 12-step meetings and addiction. What inspired that song?
Well, a lot of the guys that I lived with in the bunkhouse hadn't come from, you know, from cowboy stock. They hadn't grown up on ranches or anything like that. They'd found their way there from other places, and a number of them had and found that they really didn't feel real comfortable in polite society, if you will, and thought that they'd best just sort of stash themselves out somewhere where they can't get in trouble. Or they were running from something, some of them from heartbreak, that kind of thing. And I was kind of going, when I was writing that lyric, I was kind of going for a guy that you would find in a bunkhouse who was there for that reason. He'd run afoul of love and was trying to sort out how he was going to go about his life, probably without someone that he'd lost and someone that he'd intended to make a big part of his life. And so, I just sort of invited that character through, into our little world. And he told me that he wanted to start someplace real bleak. Mm. And the curtain wants to come up on that particular act, on that first act, on the bleakest possible settings. And so I sort of nosed around and I found pretty bleak place for him, a church basement on a Friday night when he would otherwise have been out having, you know, some sort of blowout or a real swell time. And I put him in, you know, a 12-step meeting. And then I let him tell his story. And the story went from there into how his relationship had gone south. He'd taken up the bottle. Probably among other things, but that's where we settled. And what that had led him to, and so he just threw up his hands and said, I'm going somewhere where things are simpler. Hmm. And so that's where we end up with the song, and he's punching cows.
You know, the Grateful Dead had a long and intense history with drugs. Like, the band got its break as the house band for Ken Kesey's Acid Test, and ever since then the Dead had been linked to psychedelics. And you know, you've been forthright saying that for a time LSD was very informative to your way of thinking. But, you know, there was a lot of tragedy around drugs and alcohol in the Grateful Dead. Band members, you know, either died from overdose like Brent Midland, or from drug or alcohol related illnesses like Pigpen. And of course, Jerry Garcia. And I'm not really sure what my question is, but I guess I was thinking about all that history and we listened to that song. And I was wondering how it might have informed the way you wrote it.
Christ, I don't know how to address that. Well, I can't deny that I had a fair bit of, either personal experience with drugs, alcohol, or whatever, or close friends of mine had intense experiences with them. So I kind of, I guess I know what I'm talking about to mm-hmm. some degree when I'm helping a character flesh himself out mm-hmm. In that regard.
If you're just joining us, we're listening to the interview our producer Sam Brigger recorded with Bob Weir. His new album is called Blue Mountain. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Constant Contact. With email marketing features like drag-and-drop editing and mobile-friendly templates, Constant Contact is committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits become marketers. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where teams of medical experts focus on the treatment of only one disease, cancer, every stage, every day. Learn more at cancercenter.com.
This is Fresh Air. We're listening to the interview our producer Sam Brigger recorded with Bob Weir. Weir has just released his first album of new material in 30 years. It's called Blue Mountain. Weir co-founded the Grateful Dead with Jerry Garcia. Here's one of the songs Weir co-wrote for the Dead, Sugar Magnolia.
Sugar magnolia, blossoms blooming, heads all empty and I don't care.
Saw my baby down by the river,
knew she'd have to come up soon for air.
Sweet blossom, come on, under the willow, we can have high times if you look back. We can discover the wonders of nature,
rolling in the rushes down by the riverside. She's got everything we like for. She's got everything I need. Takes the wheel when I'm seeing double. Pays my ticket when I speed.
When the Grateful Dead started playing, you were 17 years old. And you lived on Ashbury Street at the height of the counterculture in San Francisco. And the Grateful Dead and its music was really at the heart of that movement in a lot of ways. You know, at 17, were you prepared for that? It seems like such a young age to have all that thrust upon you.
I was ready for anything, come on. I was 17, 18, and the Hate Ashbury was popping. Now, this was the summer of 66, mm-hmm. spring and summer of 66. That was the real summer of love, the 67... The media made it into something that we didn't recognize, you know, and called attention to it. And everything that had rattled loose in the rest of the country ended up in the Haight-Ashbury, and things went kind of sideways there by then. But in '66, the Haight-Ashbury was a youth ghetto, but it was a joyful place.
You were adopted when you were born. And you met your birth parents pretty late in life when you were around 50 years old. And right. And I guess you had a close relationship with your father until he died last year. What did you learn about yourself from finally getting to meet him?
Well, for instance, little things like I always go outdoors to clip my fingernails and toenails. And he did too. There are little mannerisms that you would think that would be you'd pick up by watching, but they were there. We walked, we carried ourselves the same way. We had the same sort of sense of humor. Hmm. That kind of thing. He was a gentleman. He was an innate gentleman, and I think of myself as such as well. And he had a quality of leadership. He was basically born to it, and people always relied on him for it. And I've found that's more or less come my way as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a gig. Everybody has to have one. And people look to me for leadership a lot. It's just something that I can provide. It's not something that I want. You know, I'd rather people left me alone, but in that regard. But someone's got to do it.
So over the years, you must have imagined what your birth parents were like. How did that compare to actually meeting them?
As it turns out, my dad, he had no idea I existed to begin with. He had had an affair with a girl in Tucson where they were going to school, and she got pregnant and very quietly slipped away and had me in San Francisco, the famous liberal city back then, and then came back and never let on that anything had happened. Hmm. And so when we met, you know, it was a big surprise to both of them. Now, I found out about his existence. My birth mother, after my adopted parents, a number of years after my adopted parents had checked out, she contacted me because I'd tried to find her, and it was not possible. So she ended up contacting me, and she had 12 other kids, so wow. I didn't I didn't feel like I needed to complicate her life all that much.
Mm-hmm.
But we kept in touch, and I'd call her on Mother's Day, and every now and again we'd see each other and stuff like that. I'd send her flowers, that kind of thing. But she gave me my birth father's information last she knew of it, and he was a guy named Jack Parber, and he had been a student at University of Arizona. And so I got a private eye with within about 10 minutes. He turned out the information that he was the commanding officer at the local Air Force base. And I sort of packed that under my pillow for a few years because I'm pathologically anti-authoritarian. And I didn't figure that I needed the rejection that I was sure to find from this guy who's probably some sort of military authoritarian kind of guy. Then not long after Jerry checked out, my curiosity got to the point where I couldn't live with it anymore. And so I had to find that out. And I figured I had three choices. I could drive up to his house in Novato, up north of where I live, you know, about, oh, maybe 8-10 miles from as a crow flies from where I live, and just knock on his door. And I figured, okay, that I don't want my first and last vision of my father watching him clutch his heart and fall over backwards.
Yeah.
I figured I could write him a letter, but he might crumble that up and throw it away. So I figured, okay, I'll call him. And so I did, and he was on another line. I was disturbing him at the time. I said, "Listen, can you call back in 10 minutes?" I told him, "Listen, my name is Robert Weir, and I live in Mill Valley, and I've been doing some research and turned up some information that might be of considerable interest to you." And he said, "Okay, well, I'm on another line right now. Can you call me back in 10 minutes? And so that was a long 10 minutes I waited.
Yeah.
Called him back and said, "Can I ask you a question or two regarding certain events that took place in Tucson 50 years ago? And he got real quiet, and he said, "Well, okay." And I said, "Well, did you know and were you perhaps romantically involved with a young lady by the name of Phyllis back in that time?" And he said, "Well..." And he was alone. I could kind of hear it over the phone. He said, "Well, yeah." And I said, "Okay, well, sir, I don't know how many kids you have, but there's a strong likelihood that you have one more than you know." And he got real quiet. Hmm. And then he said, "Okay, the only Bob Weir that I know of is this guy who sings and plays with the Grateful Dead." Hmm. Apparently his kids were... fans. And I said, "Well, sir, that would be me." And then it got quiet again. And we talked for a little while, and then we met the next day for lunch at both of our favorite Mexican restaurant in here in Marin County. And we got real tight real fast.
As you say, he was a retired colonel, and he flew bombing missions in the Korean War. And as you said, you were anti-authoritarian, and as a kid, you know, you were anti-war and a peace lover. Do you think in some ways that you were able to accept him more when you were older and more mature than you would have if you had known him as a teen?
It would have been horror had I grown up in his house, for both of us. But by the time we met, we were more than ready to see the other sides of ourselves. Because I guess I can tend to be kind of authoritarian in my own way. And he was more or less a peace and love kind of guy in his own way. It's just that life had not called on him to be that way or called on me to be the other way. And so we saw in each other a lot of ourselves, love it or hate it.
There's a touching story that one of his sons, I think, died of spinal cancer.
Yeah.
But he was a musician, too.
Yeah.
And the family gave you that guitar. And for a long time, you would play that guitar on stage, right?
Yeah. And it finally got stolen.
Oh, it did? Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah.
And the son was a Grateful Dead fan, wasn't he?
Well, all four of his sons were Grateful Dead fans, though the one who I never met was probably the least a Grateful Dead fan. He was more on his own. He was kind of into, that country-esque style of music that was real popular back in the 70s. He was a flashy but good Telecaster player.
Well, if anyone's listening who stole that guitar, you should really give that back.
Right.
So this 56, album, 56, yeah, it was a 56 Telecaster, yeah. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, we're listening to the interview our producer Sam Brigger recorded with Bob Weir. His new album is called Blue Mountain. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview our producer Sam Brigger recorded with Bob Weir. Weir co-founded the Grateful Dead with Jerry Garcia. He's just released his first album of new material in 30 years. It's called Blue Mountain.
In the documentary about you called The Other One, you say, "Chances are I've spent more time on stage playing guitar and singing than any other human that ever lived." And the Grateful Dead played thousands of shows, had an endless touring schedule until 1995 when Jerry Garcia died, and then you kept that pace up for a very long time afterwards. You've really spent a lot of your life on the road. Why do you think that lifestyle suits you?
I'm not sure it suits anyone, really, but if you have to have the music, then if you have to have that interaction with people, then you don't have much of a choice. You just have to take the good with the bad with that lifestyle. Once you've had goosebumps in front of a bunch of people, the spirit, I guess, the spirit of joy or whatever it is that the music is carrying with it, comes through you and you share it with a bunch of folks. It's going to define your existence, and you're not going to be drawn much of anywhere else, I don't think. Not everybody gets to live that, but once you do live that, there's no other place to go.
You and Jerry Garcia were the two lead singers of the Grateful Dead, and he died in 1995. And you've said before that he was like an older brother to you. At some point, you started singing his songs in shows. Was that tough for you? Was that an easy decision to make? And was it hard for you to sing those songs at first?
No, actually, it was a while before I decided I was going to go ahead and do it. I just had to feel it out. I knew it was coming, but I didn't know when. So I just waited until the time was right. You know, early on with Rat Dog, after Jerry checked out, I didn't do much Grateful Dead material at all. I did as little as I could to still keep people coming in the doors, but I wasn't quite ready to go back there. And it's not an emotional sort of deal. I guess there was a little of that involved, but I just wanted to take a pause. It just seemed like I oughta. Mm-hmm. And then when I started doing it again, slowly all the songs came, and one by one, they just sort of, they demanded that, okay, it's time. I got to breathe again, and you can help me do this. And so I went with it.
Well, Bob Weir, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
Bob Weir spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Weir's new album is called Blue Mountain. If you want to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, like yesterday's interview with Bruce Springsteen, check out our podcast. You'll catch that and many other interviews.
Well, if I'm alone, will you take my hand? Will you stand by me in the pouring rain? With my sudden sins, my contraband, and the vanity that still remains, I'm going gone. To Gonesville, I'm going gone. To Gonesville.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Anne Rebaldonato, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simone, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. I'm Terry Gross.
Well, here come thunder, here come the rain, hear that whistle moan, here come the misery train. Well, they say it might rain forever, well, it sure can't rain on me. I'm about to get gone. I'm about to be free. I'm going gone.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Zillow, with millions of photos of homes for sale and for rent, historical pricing data, and other tools for home buyers. Zillow, find your way home. And from Carbonite, an automatic cloud backup service for protecting and recovering digital photos, documents, and other files from anywhere. Learn more at carbonite.com.